You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
It's Dear Science with Professor Steve Poynting.
It is Dear Science. Welcome. How are you, Steve?
I'm great. Thanks, Daniel. How are you?
Good. And we're going to try something a little bit different for this Dear Science. If you want to get in touch with us, the number is 309-3879. We'll try and take some calls. We've never done this kind of thing before, so we'll see how it pans out. But yeah, if you have any thoughts on what we're going to be talking about over the next 10 or so minutes, call in and we'll see if we can get you on air to talk to Steve and I.
Yeah, sounds great.
Great. Okay, so first off, why are we ticklish, Steve?
Ticklishness, yes. Look, I want everybody to try something now. You know, just stroke the back of your neck or anywhere else that you feel is a little bit ticklish. It doesn't feel that great, does it? But now if you're sitting with someone else, let them do it to you. And it feels a whole lot nicer, regardless of whether you fancy them or not. And the reason is that tickling is a... excuse me. Tickling is a very useful response, and I'm going to explain why today based on a study that's just released in the journal Science this week. So, look, we've known for ages that different parts of our bodies are ticklish. Some people are more ticklish than others. And, you know, why is it, for example, that we laugh and giggle? Why does tickling make us feel good and happy? So, you know, it's a question that's bothered a lot of people, and even through the ages. So, believe it or not, Aristotle and even Charles Darwin sort of pondered this question, but no one's really come up with an answer. What's the point in being ticklish? And hopefully, this new study will give the answer. It's a study, like many, that explains sort of human traits. It's a study on rats. And as you know, I'm rather fond of rats. So when I started to read this study, I got very excited, because what these scientists did was they studied rats, because rats actually do laugh, just like humans, when they get tickled. But it's in the ultrasonic range, so it's very hard to detect unless you've got a special little microphone. But rats enjoy being tickled.
Good, great.
A lot of rats.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Olivia is in studio as well.
Yeah. We don't have any rats here, though, don't worry. But hey, the study sounded great, because what the scientists did was they actually tickled and played with the rats and stroked their bellies and their feet, and the rats started laughing. And I thought, oh, this is lovely, I'd like to do this. But then I read a bit deeper, and of course what they then did was stick electrodes in their brains and slice the brains up to see what was going on. Yeah. So, as you know, I'm very anti-animal experimentation. So despite the unsavory nature to the end of experiment, it was very interesting, because what the scientists did was they showed that there's a lateral sort of lump in our brains about halfway back. If you sort of put your hand on top of your head, it's the very sort of middle part of your skull, if you like. And in this part of the brain, there's a little... region called the somatosensory cortex. And what the scientists noticed was, when the rats were tickled, this part of the brain lit up with activity. And so what they were able to do was identify what tickling does. It lights up that part of the brain. And because we know so much about brains now, about, you know, which part of the brain governs what actions, what they were able to do was say, look, we think that this tickling is essentially a way of resetting your body to better receive and determine tactile stimulation, so basically touch. And so it doesn't, you know, take a great leap to then say, well, look, in social animals, which rats are, and in fact humans are as well, even though some of us are antisocial, it's actually it's a reward system. So essentially, if you get tickled, makes you laugh, it resets your ability to determine, you know, physical signals of interaction, and the laughing is just a byproduct that lets the other person know that you're not displeased with the physical touch.
But that gets a bit tricky, though, because sometimes you are.
Oh, I know, sometimes. I remember being tickled so hard sometimes, you know, that I just wanted to cry. But, you know, of course, that's taking things to the extreme, because then overstimulation overly contactful tickling yeah, might not be something that was encouraged. And so there's a lot of interesting research ahead, I think, in this, to try and understand what role did that play in humans as they started to develop, you know, complex societal interactions.
Do you know what role it did play?
Well, no, nobody knows yet. But I think what this has done is show us what part of the brain is activated by tickling. So that was the big finding. But now, of course, now we know that part of the brain is also linked to our perception and our processing of physical stimuli. I think now we can perhaps start to interface this with behavioural science and anthropology, and start to work out, you know, just how important tickling's been through the ages.
And moving on to our next story, this is about chimps. And we're talking about male chimps in particular. What's the deal with them? How can they be good at being a stud and also good at being a dad at the same time?
Yeah, look, some of you guys might be getting all excited out there, but remember, chimps are our closest living relatives, so they're very useful to study, because, especially if you want to understand, again, how human society has developed and how our behaviours developed. But they're also extremely promiscuous, and chimps quite often are not bothered the gender or the relationship of, you know, so brothers, sisters, you know, same sex, different sex, doesn't really matter to them.
Great.
So, you know, if you're really that desperate to be a chimp, you know, run off to the jungle. But here's the thing. With chimps, it's always been assumed that because of this promiscuity and because of the apparent lack of care, that the males in chimp society don't bother investing in parental care. And in fact, you know, most infants, you see them bonding with the mother, and the mother will look after the infant until it's able to look after itself. However, what this new study has done, it's based on data from the Jane Goodall Institute in Tanzania. They've analysed 25 years worth of chimp behavioural data, mainly photography and video, and processed it and tried to really get to the bottom of you know, why is it that the males apparently do this? And what they found was quite surprising. It's actually that the males do invest a lot more care in looking after the infants. And furthermore, and this was very surprising, they were able to recognise which ones were theirs. Mm. So why is this interesting? Well, what it means is that males, when they interact with females, are not doing so just because they, you know, want to get lucky, which is what had been the assumption. And certainly it was shown that it didn't increase their chance of being the father of the next child if they hung out with a particular female. And instead, the correlation was whether or not with that female having an infant that was actually sired by the males. So essentially it showed that, yeah, these chimps may be highly promiscuous, but the males do invest significant effort to care for their offspring.
And
this is known in social science circles as the paternal effort hypothesis. So it's not that they're associating with the mothers per se, it's that they're associating with their babies. And, you know, I think it's interesting because, again, it harks back to, you know, if you imagine when we sort of just emerged out of Africa and we're developing our own version of society, it shows you that even perhaps when, you know, notions of marriage and fidelity were perhaps not commonplace, that probably still, you know, in very primitive human civilizations, there were probably still quite a lot of care exerted by both parents for the young.
And evolutionarily, why... what benefit does that have, having the, you know, such high promiscuity, but, you know, then caring for your biological offspring?
Well, really, the answer is in the question, to be honest with you, Daniel. So, first of all, looking after your offspring ensures that your genes are passed on to the next generation. Mm. That's, you know, inherent to what we do. But, of course, being promiscuous means you can also sire offspring with as many different females if you're a chimp. And that adds genetic diversity to your lineage, to your offspring. And of course, the more genetically diverse the offspring are, the more able they are as a population, able to withstand, you know, perhaps a disease that affects 1 out of 3 or 10 out of 20 chimps. So it's actually a huge advantage in nature if you can both protect your offspring and also make your offspring as diverse as possible.
And we're just going to go from tickling and chimp mating, and we're going to bring it down a notch, and we're going to talk about seasonal depression.
Hey, look, I've got to be honest, I'm pretty sure I've had this winter. It's been a rotten winter. And, you know, I grew up in Northern Europe, where certainly in Scandinavia, school children during the winter are actually made to sit in front of you know, sunbeds, essentially, for their lunch break, because it is a recognized phenomenon that lack of sunlight can make you miserable. But this new study has taken things a little bit further, and it's interesting because they've identified that it's sunshine exactly that causes this problem. It's not pollution, it's not wind, it's no other variable, it's not pouring rain or cloudy days. It's all about sunshine. And it's quite interesting because it came about from a chance meeting in a corridor in Brigham Young University in the US between a physicist who was studying weather and a psychologist who was studying behavior. Mm. And what they did was they correlated a whole bunch of weather and climate variables with clinical data on people reporting symptoms of mild depression. And what they found was the most significant correlation was between the time of sunrise and sunset, i.e. day length, and depression. And, you know, it's really not a surprise, because when you think about it, everyone knows about vitamin D and the fact that vitamin D is synthesized in our skin as a result of exposure to sunlight. And so, you know, for anyone who doesn't know, we have compounds called cholesterols in our skin, and these are modified by sunlight and turned into sort of the building blocks of vitamin D. But there's a lot of other things that exposure to sunlight does, and certainly one of the important ones is it kills odor-causing bacteria. So, you know, if you don't fancy using deodorant, get out in the sun, you know, get those pits exposed. No, it really does work. And then, of course, for anyone who travels regularly, you'll know about melatonin. Mm. Melatonin is another compound which is regulated through a gland called the pineal gland in our brain, which is often called the third eye in humans, because it responds to light.
Yeah.
But this gland regulates the amount of melatonin. And It's very important, because if you are lacking in melatonin, if your cycle is interrupted, say, by a long airplane journey, you often have trouble getting to sleep.
Exactly.
And that's why a lot of people take melatonin pills to try and reset that. But there are other things too. So biorhythms, you know, the way that we respond to all sorts of stimuli in our lives are regulated by a group of genes called the Chi genes. And these, it's been suggested, respond to sunlight. And then if anyone suffers from any autoimmune diseases like eczema or fibromyalgia or MS, these diseases, there's a strong correlation between relief to a lesser or greater degree of symptoms and exposure to sunlight. So, you know, really interesting study. But what I was trying to get to by talking on this story was the fact that I think it missed a point, and that was that I think there's an awful lot of subclinical data out there. That, you know, a lot of us feel miserable in the winter, but we don't go and see the doctor or seek counselling for it. We just put it down to the winter blues. And so I'd be really interested to know if people really feel that they've, you know, that their mood is affected by that whole sort of winter summer change. And you know, I'm just wondering whether we need to have a conversation in New Zealand about whether we need to go down the route of the Scandinavians and sort of have a little sort of sun lounger in some of our schools during the winter months.
I have so many questions about off the back of that, but we've got a caller on the line, I believe. Hello, how are you?
Hello.
Hi, what's your name?
Hello, lovely BFM. My name's Jax. And I don't really want to talk about promiscuous chimps, but just really quickly, I wanted to thank you guys for your wonderful coverage down at the Expo, the Weapons of War one. And just give a little plug for March for Peace on Saturday, please, which really is a peace protectors event, not a protesters event.
All right, cheers. Thank you very much, Jax. Do you have any science questions at all you'd like to ask Professor Steve Poynting?
We're all relegated to primates, really, aren't we, when elections are happening? So, I mean, basically, maybe some of our chimpanzees and gorillas and whatever could probably teach us a thing or two, don't you think?
I think they just elected a chimpanzee to the presidency, didn't they? Or something quite close.
But unfortunately, they might have elected a female one too. I can't really see much difference between the two of them, actually.
Great. Thank you very much, Jax. That was great. That was lovely. I've got so many questions about that, but we are running out of time. Why was it linked to just the day length itself? Do you think that was linked to sleep somehow, or vitamin D, or?
That's a really good question. So basically, it's not whether or not it's a sunny day, although that's part of the equation. It's actually day length, because of course, if you're only getting 6 hours or less of daylight, then your body has much less time to react, and we don't need, you know, extreme sunny days for our bodies to synthesize vitamin D and carry out all those other processes. We just need exposure to daylight. And there's a very good reason that we don't have extreme sunlight here. You know, we have a wonderful ozone layer, and we've got filtering for lots of those harmful UV rays. But some of the UV is, of course, important.
And we've got one more caller on the line. We'll just take this, and then we will head off from Dear Science. How are you?
Very good, my man, very good.
What's your name?
My name's Clint.
Clint, how are you?
Cruising, bro, cruising.
Great. What question do you
have? Just like to thank you for the brilliant topic. I lived overseas. I lived on the Gold Coast for 10 years. And two things, sunshine, and I think what it does is it makes you get outside and do stuff.
I have noticed that, yeah, it affects you in an interesting way when the sun sets earlier, doesn't it? You kind
Everyone
of feel like
wants
bedtime.
To do things. You notice, Auckland, when that sun's out, man, everything's, it's just a good buzz.
That's right. Everyone creeps out of the woodwork and heads to the beach, don't they?
Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, and then you've got the beach, then you've got the salt, then you've got the sun, then you've got the activity. Definitely winter blues. I'd say great topic. Thanks for bringing it up.
Great. Cheers, great. Clint. Thank you very much. All right, that is all we have time for today on Dear Science. We're going to go to an ad break now, and we'll be back right after this with talking about earthquake tourism and how Kaikoura is going to be affected.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.